It's time for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 3 years has shared with us her decades' research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative and judicial processes in America. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon, Dialogue Conspiracy. In Carmel, California, it's October the 28th. This is program number 168. No more sunny days to talk about in Carmel. We're having a rainstorm, and it looks like fall and winter are on their way, in our hometown at least. I want to remind you, in Boston University, WBUR is having their fundraising the last few weeks and the weeks that come. I received a letter from them. And they have informative programs such as Dialogue Conspiracy and many other good programs that you don't have an opportunity to hear on other radio stations. So those of you that enjoy the privilege of this kind of FM station should contribute something towards WBUR and not take these programs for granted. So anybody who can reach in their pockets and send some money, we very much appreciate it. They have a fundraising called Right Now. You can call them at 533-2790. Their marathon starts November the 11th, but I'm giving it a pitch for a few weeks because some people may be out of town in November, but around in October. So if you have some money for WBUR, call up and donate this money so they can continue these type of programs, because they do pay KLRB for these tapes. We charge the cost of duplicating the tapes. I don't receive any money for these. I donate my time here, and we send them off at cost. And everybody is pulling their efforts and energy together to get information to the people. But the people have the broadcasting stations, do have an investment in machinery and equipment, and to keep going, they have to, when they get these kind of programs, they have to dig into their pockets for the money. So if you can contribute towards those fundings, then you get an opportunity to get programs across the country and all the way out west. It seems like a long way away, but we're really not that far apart, and certainly not in ideas, and that's Carmel, California. I received a call from Boston this weekend. I will be coming back in person to Boston to be a conference the end of January and February 1st and 2nd on conspiracies, on the national conspiracy. So I will be in Boston to meet some of you listeners. I'm looking forward to that. But in the meantime, keep the station strong and send them money, whatever you can afford, to keep the program going. I think it's important today to talk about a subject which I keep pushing at all levels, the opening of the major, what I call the major assassinations, the major conspiracies of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King, and tie those together. The news this week is just filled with information about these assassinations, new evidence coming out. If you heard Zodiac News Service earlier, before my program started, there was an account from Reverend Brochures, who was a roommate of David Ferry in New Orleans, who is revealing information about David Ferry's plans to fly the assassins, the men who assassinated John Kennedy, out of Houston, Texas, after John Kennedy was murdered in 1963. Those of you who remember the 60s, the years of the 60s and early 70s of being ones of major conspiracies and assassinations, will know the 70s as being the year where these balloon bubbles break. One of the cases that's so important to us here in California has to do with men that are in power at the present time that are involved in concealing the conspiracy to murder Robert Kennedy. And the elections do come up this next Tuesday, a week from today, and those of you get the station at the end of the week, it'll be the few days from the time you hear this. I do not make it a policy to talk about political candidates or issues on my program. I stick to political conspiracies pretty carefully. But there is a gentleman running for office this time who I have hit very hard at. I've criticized week after week almost. And he is running for the Attorney General of California in our elections again against a Mr. Norris, Wim Norris. That man is Evel Younger, Evel J. Younger. I hit at him because he's behind the heart of what I call Watergate West. Watergate East included President Richard Nixon and John Mitchell and Patrick Gray, acting head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover when he was alive, and the Justice Department, Robert Mardian and Jerris Leonard, and the men who perverted the courts, who lock up the innocent, and the guilty are out walking the streets. Watergate West is a series of murders and conspiracies in Santa Cruz area, in Los Angeles, in California, within the prisons. And the big daddy of them all is Evel J. Younger, who was a district attorney in Los Angeles, mentioned in the Glass House tapes by Lewis Tackwood, his relationships of military intelligence. He's still a general in the military. His military intelligence links to the White House, to the CIA, to the secret Houston team. And because Younger is running for election, I thought I'd bring to you some important information that I have read on the radio show several times through the last 2 years, but I don't like to duplicate shows. But with the election coming up, I think I should bring it up again. It has to do with a lawsuit filed in Los Angeles by Theodore Chirac versus the Los Angeles Police Department, dated June 4th, 1970, in the Superior Court of the State of California for the County of Los Angeles, number 978371, complaint for disclosure of information. And I want to share this with you because Evel Younger is running for the Attorney General. It's based on Government Code 54950. The plaintiff, Theodore Chirac, on behalf of himself and all other residents of the State of California, plaintiff, versus the Los Angeles Police Department, Edward M. Davis, individually and as Chief of Police of the City of Los Angeles, and representative of the class of members of the Los Angeles Police Department, Robert Houghton, individually and as Deputy Chief of the Police of the City of Los Angeles, and author of a published book, Special Unit Senator, Evel J. Younger, individually and as District Attorney of the County of Los Angeles, and as representative of the class of members of the Office of the District Attorney of Los Angeles County and DOES 1 through 50 inclusive. The defendant, the plaintiff, alleges on behalf of himself and all other residents of the State of California, number one, the subject matter of this action is one of common or general interest of many persons, so numerous it is impracticable to bring them all before the court. Two, this action is brought pursuant to Government Code 54950, which provides as follows. In enacting this chapter, the legislature finds and declares that the public commissions, boards, and councils, and other public agencies in this state exist to aid in the conduct of the people's business. It is the intent of the law that their actions be taken openly and their deliberations be conducted openly. The people of this state do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them. The people, in delegating authority, do not give their public servants the right to decide what is good for the people to know and what is not good for them to know. The people insist on remaining informed so that they may retain control over the instruments they have created. Defendant Evel J. Younger is, and at all times herein mentioned, has been the District Attorney of the County of Los Angeles, State of California. As such, he is its public prosecutor, responsible for the prosecution of all public offenses. He is responsible for the supervision, control, and regulation and management of the office of the district attorney and for the trial of all felonies committed within the County of Los Angeles, and particularly the trial known as the People of the State of California versus Sirhan Bishara Sirhan, alleging the murder of Senator Robert F. Kennedy. He is empowered and has the responsibility to set the policy for and to make and enforce all necessary and desirable rules and regulations of said office of the district attorney. He is sued individually and in his capacity as representative of the members of the office of the district attorney who have suppressed and continue to suppress important, valuable, relevant information concerning the investigation of the murder of Senator Robert Kennedy, particularly the prosecution and the trial of Sirhan Sirhan. And he continues to deprive the citizens and residents of the State of California of the full and uncensored information concerning the said matter. Now, this complaint goes into all the evidence that there was a conspiracy and repeats that the Government Code 54950 has been put aside deliberately, intentionally, and knowingly. They have suppressed facts and evidence within their knowledge. This is Chief of Police Ed Davis. And Robert Houghton, who just got a new large government grant and has a official capacity in Sacramento at the present time, and Evel J. Younger. They continue to usurp the right of the people to remain informed on the report on the part of the said defendants, and each of them attempting to decide what is good for the people to know and what is not good for them to know. And in this report, it goes into the special investigation, the special unit senator that was a task force that was selected by the Los Angeles Police Department, and this department was under the direction of Chief of Detectives Robert Houghton. Special unit senator was ostensibly satisfied that no conspiracy existed, and after 4,800 interviews and many official actions, it closed the investigation July 25th, 1969. There were 10 volumes of the official account of the investigation, and only 3 copies are in existence today and are not made public to any investigators such as myself who worked on the John Kennedy assassination and saw that that was a conspiracy. In Special Unit Senator, Robert Houghton said that not one shred of evidence exists at this date to indicate any conspiracy in the death of Senator Robert Kennedy. Now, there were significant questions in this matter. Number one, how many bullets were found in the people, in the walls, when Senator Kennedy was assassinated? In the book, in the investigation, they had no intimation in Robert Houghton's book, no answer to this question. The evidence exists that there were 10 bullets were found, whereas Sirhan's gun contained no more than 8 bullets, and he only got off 2 or 3 at the very most. Another question is, what is the list of all the persons who were with or near Senator Kennedy at the time when he was shot? Robert Houghton's book does not answer these questions at all. He eliminates them. The truth is that the cook at the Ambassador Hotel was important. The guard that guarded Robert Kennedy was important. Question 3, a temporarily employed hotel guard was accompanying Senator Kennedy and drew his revolver at the time Sirhan shot at Kennedy. What was his name? Was the information found in Robert Houghton's book? His name was Thane Eugene Caesar. He's mentioned in one sentence on page 174 in Houghton's book. No other information is given about him in the book, and evidence exists that Caesar could have shot Kennedy and that all of Sirhan's bullets missed Robert Kennedy. There are many more questions to be asked that are not answered in the official book, and then those 3 copies were locked up and are not available for researchers, although it consisted of 10 volumes of information. There were 10 bullets removed in the Ambassador Hotel, although Sirhan's gun could only get out 8 if he was able to do them. And I've added them up for you before from the 8-shot revolver. One was in Robert Kennedy's head. That was a back shot from the bottom up. One was from Robert Kennedy's neck. One was recovered from Paul Schrade's head. One was recovered from Elizabeth Evans' forehead. One was from the abdomen of William Weisel. One was recovered from the left thigh of Ira Goldstein. One was from the left leg of Irwin Stroll. 2 were from the center divider in the kitchen, and 1 from the door frame of the backstage. That's 10 bullets from an 8-shot revolver. And it was the job of the district attorney to open up this information, which Evel Younger has not done, and as far as I know, has never answered this suit, never gone to court. They've never had the satisfaction. I don't know whether he plays God like Howard Hughes or doesn't have to answer this. I never had any information from the researchers that he ever appeared to answer these charges. There are many more charges in this complaint that I could read. Carl Euchre was the maitre d' at the hotel, who was escorting Kennedy through the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel. He moved quickly and grabbed Sirhan's arm, he said, after the second shot. Euchre saw a security guard with his gun drawn in his hand, and defendants, this is Evel Younger, Chief of Police Davis, and Robert Houghton, deliberately and intentionally and knowingly suppressed the evidence from the people in the state of California by not giving it to the grand jury or the trial of Sirhan. Robert Houghton said in his book that there was nobody in the Ambassador Hotel of right-wing connections, whereas Thane Caesar, the man who allegedly had the gun and pulled it, who stood behind Robert Kennedy, was a member of a right-wing, very vocal supporter of George Wallace and the right wing and the American Independent Party. He was associated with right-wing views and activities. He expressed verbally his hatred for the Kennedy family, his resentment of liberal ideas. Thane Caesar also admits that he drew a gun in his hand at the same time Sirhan was firing. He was on the floor with his back against the ice machine. He was below and to the right of Senator Kennedy, and those were the directions, close enough to get powder burns on himself. The shot that fatally wounded Senator Kennedy came from the back to the front, from down to up, from the right to left. Sirhan was never in that position. Caesar was. He admitted he had a .22 caliber pistol similar to Sirhan's, but he didn't know the whereabouts at the time. This suit was filed in 1970. The autopsy confirmed that Senator Kennedy died as a result of gunshots at this direction, going upwards from the back, a few inches from the back of the head. The evidence is overwhelming of a conspiracy in the Ambassador Hotel. This is only one conspiracy I'm talking about. Evelyn Younger, whose name was mentioned, the Glass House tapes, the Lewis Tackwood book, his connections to the White House secret intelligence team, which Tackwood revealed in 71 and turned out to be the Tom Charles Houston plan, which did in fact exist back there in Washington, D.C., right in the White House. There are 101 reasons for me as a researcher into political conspiracies and assassinations to recommend to people voting that we have Mr. Norris as the Attorney General of the State of California. Norris has even said that he would prosecute Richard Nixon in the Ellsberg case at a local state level, not a federal level, that he intends to prosecute conspirators, which is a sign that maybe the syndrome of hiding government conspiracies would be over if Mr. Norris would take that position. It would be a start. Now, during the week, there was new evidence in the John Kennedy assassination and in the James Ray case. I briefly mentioned last week the James Ray case, which was the trial is going on now in Memphis, Tennessee. It's a preliminary trial to find out if James Ray will be allowed to have another trial to prove that he did not kill Martin Luther King. And he has to present evidence at these court hearings that he was not given a chance the first time. And he's showing how Percy Forman, his lawyer, and William Bradford Huey, the official writer of conspiracies, that no conspiracies exist, were in cahoots with the prosecution, with the defense, to frame James Earl Ray. The real killers will be found out. This is an evidentiary hearing taking place, and you may be reading a little bit about it every day. And each week I will keep you up on the latest developments of the James Ray case, because according to Bernard Fensterwald this week, who is James Ray's lawyer, it just may open up all the assassinations of the 1960s. And Fensterwald, you remember, heads the committee to investigate political assassinations, and he's also James McCord's lawyer. I always said that if we start with any one of these conspiracies, whether you work with the Martin Luther King murder or the John Kennedy or the Robert Kennedy, whoever speaks first, whoever opens it up, they'll all three be linked, and later you'll link them to the Malcolm X and the killing of George Jackson and the creation of the SLA and the Watergate operatives and the people that killed Dorothy Hunt. They're all linked, but the 1960 histories could be overturned with any one of these cases. Now, Martin Luther King was murdered April 3rd, 1968, and this assassination set off riots, which were to escalate Spiro Agnew into power. As this trial goes on, there's certain connections that I do want to bring out to the Watergate that may be important or may be coincidences. Ray is talking now about meeting a man named Raoul, R-A-O-U-L, and I wrote about that, I believe, in my second article in The Realist. He met Raoul at many places, first August 28, 1967 in Birmingham, Alabama, and Raoul bought him a Mustang, and it gave him almost $2,000 cash, and he met him at Puerto Vallard and other points. Raoul was the connecting man who provided him with funds for this interim until 68, when he was ordered to buy a gun in Birmingham and then take it to Memphis, and that gun would be found in the rooming house. Now, well, I don't know whether it's a coincidence or whether more is going to come to this, because Raoul was a gunman with Cuban connections, anti-Castro-Cuban. But Virgilio Gonzalez, one of the men caught at the Watergate Hotel in June 1972, Also use the name Araul, R-A-O-U-L, Godoy, G-O-D-O-Y, Godoy, and R-A-U-L. So the name Raul is identical to the one James Ray used and Gonzalez. Whether it's going to be coincidence or a bombshell, we're going to have to wait to see. Now, E. Howard Hunt, in his book, The Coven, published in February 72, used the alias for himself of Jonathan Galt. And James Ray, when he went to Montreal, Canada, took a 6 months lease on 2589 Notre Dame Street in Montreal under the name of Eric S. Galt. That was July 16, 1967. You have an overlap of the names that E. Howard Hunt uses in his books, the characters in his books, and he's written very many, with the aliases and the passports and the driver's license of the men arrested at the Watergate Hotel. But here you have them overlapping also into the various political assassinations like Raul in both instances and Galt. The birth certificates and the identification that James Ray used, all of his aliases, the three, came from Montreal while he was living at Montreal, and the story was that he went to a library and picked up names of certain people like Bridgman and Galt and Sneed, and that he used these, he had passports and licenses. But also the funding for the John Kennedy assassination, the Robert Kennedy, the Martin Luther King assassinations came from Montreal, also from Montreal, Canada, and we've talked about this before, from the Permandex Corporation. And we also know that the aliases and passports and driver's licenses that the CIA gave to the Watergate people for the Ellsberg robbery and for their other operations, they came from the CIA. Martinez had a Cook's Pass alias, and so did Sturgis and Barker. These were CIA produced. And here is James Earl Ray leaving a penitentiary where the head warden worked with the Bay of Pigs group, the Bay of Pigs operation. He was a lawyer, and James Ray met his brother, who works with the States Rights Party, who's a far extreme right wingist. And the next day, James Ray left and went on his way up to Illinois, and he had a Social Security card so he could get a job, an alias provided. And I said years ago that it would be written by the Central Intelligence Agency, and you'll find, as history will prove later, I'm positive that the same people that printed the credentials for the Watergate team also gave James Ray's brother this secret, this Social Security card when he went to Illinois. Now, the Mexican connections in the James Earl Ray case will be coming out if he gets a trial, I'm sure. E. Howard Hunt had CIA connections. He was a case officer in Mexico City in 63 in September, October and September. That's when he was meeting David Ferry, whose name is in the news tonight, who was flying the assassins of John Kennedy to Mexico. Well, that's the Mexican connections are heavy in all the political assassinations. The assassins are hired from Mexico and flown around the world. Well, Raul and the same Raul and Ray were meeting in Mexico October the 7th, 1967, on the other side of the border in Mexico. James Ray had been to Mexico two times, was meeting Raul, and it'll be interesting, as I say, to see if it turns out to be Gonzalez. Ray was also meeting Raul on Camp Street in New Orleans, James Ray was. And he just coincidentally happened to be in the same offices that Lee Harvey Oswald was meeting right-wingers. Oswald was on Camp Street at the same address, but he went up one door that was supposed to be the Fair Play for Cuba office, which backed up to the extreme right-wing office up through the other door off of Camp Street. And Raul and Oswald paths a couple of years. James Ray was meeting at the same area, the same offices on Camp Street that Lee Harvey Oswald. So history will show the relationship. Also, many other relationships are coming out now in a book by Mr. Chastain that's been written up in Computers and Automation. They're running a series of a forthcoming book now linking characters of the Martin Luther King assassination to the John Kennedy assassination. Now, there was an article this week that I do want to keep up, that this is some of the information coming out at the hearing, and I don't know how many of you take the papers. It's a Los Angeles Times story, so it didn't come over the AP-UP wire service, but certain information is coming out at the evidentiary hearings. A Dr. McCarthy DeMere, he's a doctor, said that he saw Ray in the jail at Shelby County pending his trial. James Ray had a one-hour trial when he was convicted for 99 years, and when Ray was with the doctor, he was telling him, "I wasn't by myself." Now it turns out that years after these murders and assassinations, Jack Ruby's doctor is talking. He gave an account in London just recently about Ruby's efforts to tell about a conspiracy. Out of the woodwork is coming this Dr. McCarthy Demir, who's saying that James Ray was telling him while he was visiting him as a physician that he didn't do it by himself. But here's an interesting switch. Dr. Demir is not only James Ray's doctor, but he's also the deputy sheriff at the same time. So James Ray's caught in as a, he's not talking to a medical man, he's talking to law enforcement, and they were behind the conspiracy. So anything he said didn't come out at the time, but it's coming out now because everybody wants to be on the safe side, and probably Dr. Demir will be called as a witness. Now, there's another interesting thing. James Ray told Dr. Demir, and keep in mind this wasn't just his physician, he's also the sheriff. He said in quotes, "I'm not going to stay in prison very long in Nashville, very long." He says when he told the doctor, quotes, and this is a sheriff also, that when he got out, that he would go to him and he wanted, but he said when he got out, he wanted me to hide him, that he'd be out soon. And the sheriff, doctor's wife, said, "Well, if he shows up, we're leaving home." Now, this is a typical clandestine operation kind of thing. The sheriff would not have reported James Ray if he was missing from the prison, just like James Ray had helped when he escaped from the Missouri prison. The point is, when James Ray escaped from the Missouri prison, he had help from the prison officials. They didn't have an alert for 24 hours that anyone was missing. The police department didn't look for him. He had the help of his brother who visited him the day before. He had his aliases and ID ready. But the very first night, James Ray gave an account of how he went to a trailer. The door was open. There was wine there. It was raining. He knew where to go and where to sleep. And then he went on to the next day to some town where he met relatives and a friend, and he was able to pick up a car and go to Illinois and go to a CIA safe house and get a job in Illinois before he went on to Canada. But the point is that the sheriff's wife says, "Well, if he comes, I'm going out." They vacate a residence. This is a typical safe house operation. Nobody will interfere with them. It's not like staying in a hotel where somebody would see him check in. A change of clothes are waiting. This happened with Donald DeFries of the SLA when he left Soledad Prison. They leave. There's a change of clothes. There's transportation. They already have their chain of command. These men are allowed to leave the prisons if they're to be used as part of a conspiracy. And then there's always a leash on them. If they don't follow orders right, you can bring them back and lock them up. But the doctor sheriff was the one that James Ray was to be with. And you see that he had hope when he was arrested. I'm sure that one of the safety valves for getting him into the operation was to tell him that they'd let him escape again. They let him escape once, and he was gone about 17 months. He went to Canada, he went to a resort hotel. He knew the woman who was to meet him. He got clothes, outfits. He went down to Birmingham. He had this expensive car. He went to Puerto Vallarta. He went to Los Angeles, and he went to bartending school. He was dancing. He was drinking. It was a far cry from his prison life. And all he had to do was to spend money and move from city to city. And then he ended up in a situation where he could be the fall guy at the Lorraine Motel. And he was the patsy for the Martin Luther King murder. So I'm sure they told him, if you get caught, you'll be escaping again. So he's telling the doctor, who he thinks is his friend, that if I get out, I'll go to your place. But the doctor also turns out to be the sheriff. And James Ray then was taken to tight solitary confinement after his one-hour trial. And the sheriff and doctor never had to house James Ray, and he's been locked up ever since. Now, it also came out at this hearing that Charles Stevens was the man at the rooming house. There were two witnesses to see if James Ray was in the rooming house after he allegedly shot Martin Luther King, and one of them was Charles Stevens, and he had said to the prosecution in Memphis that James Ray left the rooming house. But a new witness has come forward now by the name of James McGraw, who was a cab driver, who was called to the rooming house and saw Stevens and said he was dead drunk. He was laid out in the bed. It would be impossible for him to have identified any person that day. And James Earl Ray couldn't have been identified by Stevens. He was the main witness for that prosecution. As I say, James Ray, there was no trial. He pleaded guilty. He was told that he would be barbecued and get the electric chair, and so he pleaded guilty, and Stevens was to testify. Now, there was another woman, the wife of Charles Stevens, who saw James Earl Ray leave the rooming house, and Mrs. Grace Stevens, not by coincidence, following the syndrome of every political conspiracy, has been locked in a mental hospital for 5 years, if you would believe that. She is still in a mental hospital, and right after the assassination of Martin Luther King, she described a man who left the rooming house from a room that James Ray was supposed to have that did not fit the description of James Earl Ray. So the law enforcement and the news media took the witness, who was dead drunk, laid out, who couldn't be a reliable witness, and they took Mrs. Stevens away. You remember the woman who made the reservation for Martin Luther King, who changed rooms from one floor up to the balcony that he was shot at later. She was dead within just, I think, I didn't make notes here. I have the material at home. Maybe a week after Martin Luther King was murdered, she was dead. The room switch was made at the last minute, and this woman was dead. But Mrs. Stevens is still locked up in a mental hospital. Now, the Secret Service agent, Abraham Bolden, who went to Washington, D.C. to speak to the Warren Commission, the only man of the Secret Service who wanted to tell about the conspiracy to kill President Kennedy in 1963, the man who knew about the plot in Chicago, Illinois, that didn't go through, but knew about a man named Oswald and had information. Abraham Bolden was taken to a psychiatric hospital and was locked up 6 years and was just released recently. He was locked up 6 years in a mental hospital. Well, Dita Beard is still in Denver, Colorado. She revealed the ITT memos and embarrassed the Nixon administration and John Mitchell and the Justice Department and ITT. She's still a prisoner of this administration. Martha Mitchell's coming out with a new book on her, she calls it her political kidnapping. There are 8 things that she's bringing out in her book, and we'll talk about those next week. And all 8 points were in the article that I did in 1972 on why was Martha Mitchell kidnapped. And she goes in, one of the points that she brings out is that they tried to make her mentally deranged or mentally sick. And she goes more into how Richard Nixon wanted to put her into a mental hospital. So just examples of Dita Beard, Martha Mitchell, Abraham Bolden, Grace Stevens. These witnesses, if they're not murdered, are taken away and locked up. I'm sure that one of the purposes of locking them up is an intimidation to other people. If they die outright, it isn't half as threatening as taking them off to what is really like a concentration camp and frightening other people who might want to talk, because you have a living person who's suffering, who's isolated. Once they're dead, people tend to forget about them, and the example isn't as dramatic as having them alive and locked up as a lesson for other people who might want to talk. And another point brought out in the hearings this week in Memphis is the fact that James Earl Ray says that William Bradford Huey wanted to write a book about him. And the book, get this, he says the book wouldn't sell if he said there was a conspiracy. And the reason that William Bradford Huey wrote this book, They Slew the Dreamer, and got this information that was fictitious about the assassination of Martin Luther King, was that he would write a book based on the exclusive knowledge of the case, and then from that money he would pay James Ray's lawyer so that he had a one-hour trial. Now, the point was that they couldn't make money from a book if they said the conspiracy existed. And I have trouble in my own mind figuring out why a book wouldn't sell saying that there was a conspiracy. Why do books sell that do not tell the truth? I think of the Marilyn Baker book. I finally bought it, called Exclusive. It's on the SLA, and I read about 2 pages in the car just before I came in here. Practically had a heart attack. I've read enough just from the advertising of the book to want to sue Marilyn Baker for a fictitious police job that I think is not basis in fact, that it's covering the truth. There is this lawsuit that Chirac placed against Robert Houghton for his book of Special Unit Senator. And I'm going to go through the Marilyn Baker book very carefully and find the areas that she has excluded that indicate a conspiracy of government nature, police nature, FBI nature, and that she is covering, trying to make the SLA look like a radical terrorist group. And she's getting thousands of dollars of advertising in national magazines, Newsweek, Chronicle, New York Times. I'm saving the answer just to see the massive amount of information. Her book begins with the story of the 2 black men that took Patty Hearst away, and she doesn't explain where the other black man is. She tells you all of her findings and things that she can do that the FBI can't do, and yet she can't find that second man that kidnapped Patricia Hearst. And she goes into the terrorists and the radical politics of the Berkeley area, which is the purpose of these books. And so back to the James Ray case, we have in every political conspiracy the mass media fed with advertising and pumping the fictitious books. And James Ray is saying that the book, they told him that if they wrote a conspiracy book, it wouldn't sell. And I just don't know why the books that lie about our history are able to sell and why a conspiracy book wouldn't sell. Or is it just that the publishers are pumped with money to perpetuate the lie that they're attached to the Pentagon in some way that is not objective in any shape or fashion, and they give us these lies? Well, Bernard Fensterwald brought out this week at James Ray's trial that Ray knows the name of a man who will provide him with information, who was to provide him with an alibi, and that this man also was at another location when Dr. King was killed, and that he's going to be naming names as the case goes on. The defense attorney, the court-appointed defense attorney for James Earl Ray when he had his one-hour trial, his name is Hugh Stanton, Jr. from Memphis, and he said he worked closely on the Ray case. He said, we checked everything possible we could, and many things pointed to Ray's guilt, such as items around the house, the flop house, the beer cans, the binoculars, and what he believed to be the murder weapon. So the court-appointed lawyer for James Earl Ray was saying we did as much as we could with all the items found around. But obviously Ray wanted to tell what happened, but the defense lawyer wouldn't even listen to him any more than they listened to Jack Ruby. Well, it's a pretty sad state of affairs, except that it keeps going on. That was the James Ray case. The witnesses, some of them involved in the Martin Luther King thing, will be coming forward and naming their role in killing Martin Luther King. But this week, our dear President Gerald Ford is busy vetoing the Freedom of Information Act, which is outrageous. Here he is, a man on the Warren Commission who promises an open administration, if you can believe it. He was going to do everything open so we would know the truth and have no fear from this particular government about what was going on in our country. And then, after he's in office a short time, he not only hushes up the investigation of the criminals in Washington, D.C., and does this huge pardon for the president and allows the president, if Congress would let him, to destruct these tapes. Now he wants the Freedom of Information Act vetoed. He's vetoed it. He's promised us so much, and now he wants this big deal, and he doesn't think we should have the information. His excuse is national security. It was the same excuse they used when they covered up the Warren Report. And he's fighting to cover the conspiracies, because if that information is out, then he may sink along with it. And he can't afford to get all this information out, because then his precious Warren Commission would be thrown to the wind. Ford came out today, this is October the 28th, and this is titled his article, Self-Destruct. Ford is worried about the attitude in the U.S. And I'm going to read you his attitude, and I think he and his ilk are creating the attitude. They're directly responsible. These criminal conspirators are responsible for the attitude. We don't have an attitude that comes out of a vacuum. We have it because we know they're lying to us, and we're helpless, and we have to take some positions or pass laws or remove them. Now, here's the quotation, aboard Air Force One. President Ford says, America is afflicted with self-destruct feelings, and there's no reason why it should be. He says, He said, is what we've got to lick. This is our problem. We're condemning ourselves so much we're hurting ourselves when we should be just doing the opposite. Americans suffer a malaise that has grown out of a vague masochism, not from the seeds of wrong policy or leaders who misled, he says. Now, isn't that ridiculous? We have leaders misleading us right and left, and he tells us we're masochists. Everyone that I've contacted through radio shows or correspondence feels that we're in danger because of these leaders. And he tells us we're masochists with no reason to pick our sores and wounds. He says, Americans suffer a malaise grown out of a vague masochism, not from seeds of wrong policy or leaders who mislead us. The feeling that worries me is this. There's a self-destruct feeling among Americans. I don't point the finger at the press or anyone. But you look at it, it sort of started when they were giving John Kennedy hell, you know, in the last days before the assassination. They literally criticized, they said there was high criticism of Kennedy. Then it went uphill towards LBJ. They drove him out of office, literally. There was a sort of hiatus with Nixon. Then, because of Watergate, it burst forward. And in a refrain reminiscent of Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, who said this country needs to talk less about what's wrong with America and more about what's right, he said, that's what we've got to overcome. There's no reason why it should be. I don't blame the press. I don't blame partisanship. Somehow we've got the attitude that we're condemning ourselves so much. Now, let's get one thing straight. Americans are not condemning themselves. They're condemning Gerald Ford for his pardoning of Richard Nixon. They're condemning him for covering up the crimes that the president committed. They're condemning him for allowing tapes to be destroyed that would tell us the truth about our country. They're condemning him, the press, for vetoing the Freedom of Information Act. They're condemning him for his role on the Warren Commission. They're condemning him because he's misleading us with all kinds of deals of grains or armament or allowing the CIA, the black operations, to continue. He praises the CIA. They're instigating new computerized police departments inside the FBI that are worse than you would imagine. President Ford is being condemned. His rating has gone down as low as the others. He's part of the team of conspirators. He was on the Warren Commission with Jaworski. He's in this thing up to his neck with Ford with Nixon, Jaworski, Lyndon Johnson. They're up to their neck to the murdering and the hiding of the murdering of John Kennedy. He knows what happened in Dallas. He has all the documentation. He knows if he doesn't know, he can ask. He said to J. Edgar Hoover, it was in Volume 5, I've quoted it many times in the commission hearings, it's always an open investigation. And he tells us we're picking our sores. We're really being led down the drain by this president, just like all the others, but he can't free himself of it. Now, the spirit of his policy was to open up information, get access to files. There was a decision, a lawsuit placed in 1972 by Alan Weinstein from Smith College. He's a history professor, to get the information on the Alger Hiss case. And it was agreed by Elliot Richardson that they could have this information. Now, the Justice Department reversed it last week. They reversed the Information Act, and they cannot get the information on Alger Hiss. Alger Hiss is 70 years old, and Clarence Kelly, the director of the FBI, agreed to make the Hiss papers available. Now the Justice Department has reversed their position on the Alger Hiss case. Richard Nixon can quote it, you know, to his dying day. He pulled it out in the Watergate tapes for everyone to read. Mr. Weinstein was promised 59,000 pages of FBI data. He had $12,000 from a publisher, G.S. Putnam Sons. He had a new book coming out. He had the money for the documents. They turned over 173 pages instead of 59,000 pages. Is that masochism, or are our leaders going down the drain? The FBI reports that he got were called unusable. Every name was left out except Alger Hiss's name and Priscilla, his wife, Priscilla Hiss. Weinstein got a letter back that there was a change in policy, and the Attorney General has the sole discretion and can determine when these are released, and that is all. That is change. William Saxby says the reports on Alger Hiss or on the Julius Ethel Rosenberg case cannot be released to Professor Weinstein. There's a book called Where It All Began, The Frame-Up of Alger Hiss by G.S. Putnam and Sons. The government continues to hide a particular man, Richard Nixon, or the law enforcement agents, the FBI, that forged documents in the Rosenberg case. The Watergate isn't open, and they will not allow this information out. There was a warning coming out from the White House this week by John Eager, acting director of the White House, saying that the Justice Department decision to centralize and federally control communications and computer instruments in terms of prison investigation or criminal charges, they want to wire all of this information into large data banks, which is what I said would happen when Mr. Kelly came in. He's the expert of it. A John Eager, acting director of the White House, said this is very dangerous. It could result in the absorption of all state and local criminal data systems into a potentially abusive, centralized, federally controlled communication and computer information system. October 21st, 1974, this week. Somebody in the White House is begging people in Washington to stop. He said the FBI communications would link to the national LEAA of 50 states. It could be very dangerous. It takes away the power of the states and the privacy, and without any ado, they're wiring all 50 states together, and a man even inside the White House says an unannounced decision by the Justice Department is giving the FBI tentative approval for enlarging its communication system, which should be denounced by the White House Office of Telecommunications Policy. So Gerald Ford is calling us a masochist, and the Watergate continues. There was an article in our local paper. A speaker came out from Washington, D.C., named Bob Katz, to talk about new links of the John Kennedy assassination to the Watergate. Evidence is breaking up. There are lectures all around the country trying to inform you. There are books to read. If you need a bibliography, write to me at KLRB, and I'll send me a self-addressed envelope. I'll give you some books to read and articles to read. Well, the week is winding up. Our program is over. Time is up now. We could keep going on for another long hour or a few hours, but this is it for the week. But watch the evidence on the Kent State trial coming, that Martin Luther King will get into the Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy. They will open up in your lifetime. So read your paper and save these articles and watch how the evidence begins to flow out in the next months and the next year to come. Stay well, and I'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 10 years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KELRB-FM in Carmel, California.